Ready? Satyam mitya equals no distance between satyam and mitya. I am Atma, not my upadhi. At the same time, I am that. Please talk more about this. Okay. For satyam mitya, if to start with, if I use the rope snake example, from the standpoint of the snake, the rope is absolutely necessary, and the rope is its being. And so the truth of the snake really is the rope. Because if I pulled the rope away, there'd be no snake. The bends of the rope are the bends of the snake. Right? And so the snake itself has no independent being at all. It totally depends upon the rope. The rope is what is actually there. So from the standpoint of the snake, you know, there's no distance between the snake and the rope. It's not like there's a rope there and then a little space in between and then this imaginary snake projected on. That's not what it is. There's no distance at all. The rope is appearing as a snake, as though, without going through any change itself. And so from the standpoint of this body-mind-sense organs being mitya, like the snake, you know, it has no independent self or independent consciousness. It depends upon me totally for its being. And so then I can say from the standpoint of this body, I am the self. I am that, because there's nothing else here, really, that has any substance. My body, mind, sense organs is 100% dependent upon conscious being for its existence. It has no substance. If you try to find a substance or an actual thing here, it goes into an infinite regress of indivisibility. And it also comes into being and goes out of being. You know, so it has no satyam itself, but because it has no satyam, so no existence, no being itself, then its being is only me, you know? And so it's like going back to the pot. It's like if the pot says, I am the clay, that's true. So it is the clay, but the clay is not the pot. From the standpoint of the clay, there's only clay there, and there really is no pot. So the pot actually is a different order of reality that has no being apart from the clay. And so, But because of that, the pot can say, I am clay, and be totally correct. And I can say, I am a conscious being, and I'm totally correct, because that's exactly what I am. I am a conscious being, but the problem is that this body, mind, sense organs, because of ajnanam, takes the body to be me, and me to be the body. So when that's the case, there's no satyam mitya. Satyam mitya means this body correctly says, I am the conscious being, because that is the content, that is what actually is the set chit of this body, what actually is the substance is me. And so it depends upon me and it is me. But the other reverse way is I say, I am the Atma, I am the conscious being. And so from my standpoint as the conscious being, I have no dependence on this, on the mitya. The mitya depends upon me, but I don't depend upon it. And from my standpoint, it's not even there. How can it be there? Who's going to be experiencing it? Everything that's experienced is within mitya itself. You know, so how is consciousness, which doesn't have any eyes or mind or organs of action, going to have any knowership whatsoever to even know that there's a creation there? But because the Maya, this is just a little to make you feel better. What do you mean there's no creation? But the thing is, this this creation is a natural expression of me, of consciousness. It's just that it's mitya. It has no independent being apart from me. Yeah. But for me to experience the creation has to be there. Right? Without the creation being there, even as Ishwara, forget about the sense organs and all that, even as Ishwara, for this creation to be known, it has to be there to be known. The knownness is me, right? And then I'm as though reflected in the whole Maya Upadhi. But actually, even to say that is a little bit, it's okay, we have to use language somehow. But this creation that comes into manifestation has me for its being. It's so, and then from its own standpoint, it as though reflects me or enjoys my consciousness, the consciousness which is me. When it goes into unmanifest condition, then nothing happens at all because I'm the one that is actually there and nothing happens to me. That's why I keep using the dream example, because when you wake up from a dream, it's the most uncanny feeling. You don't even know quite how to talk about it, because when you wake up from the dream, that dream is completely gone. The namarupas, the names and forms, are completely gone. But nothing has happened. But of course something has happened. The dream is gone. And everything that was going on in it is gone. So something has happened. But the experience is that, wow, that whole dream is gone and nothing has happened. Because in reality, nothing has happened. Because what is actually there is just the satchit. That's what is actually there. And so you can't experience anything having happened because nothing has happened. Because what is not there, what is being experienced but has no being of its own, when it goes, nothing has happened. So in a way, it's an experience, it's a projection. This whole creation is a projection of infinite knowledge. But its being is only me. And so when something that has no being comes and goes, nothing has happened because the thing that has being has not changed at all. So you have this kind of uncanny recognition of how can it be that that whole world has gone away and nothing has happened. So that's why I keep asking you to notice you when you wake up from the dream, that kind of odd experience. So I think that maybe answers. So let me read it again. So you say, I am Atma, not my Upadhi. At the same time, I am that. Well, I would say, like, when you say, I am that Upadhi, from the I am perspective, there is no Upadhi. Because there's no, the consciousness has no way of experiencing it. There's no eyes or sense organs. There's no experience of any Upadhi. That's why when you're just sitting with yourself and you ask, am I knowing anything? Am I experiencing anything other than me? You don't have to say no. But from the standpoint of the Upadhi, Upadhi will say, you know, I am the conscious being. And that's true because the only thing that's there is the conscious being in reality. This mitya is of a different order of reality. This maya, this body, mind, sense, is a different order of reality that has no being at all. The being that it enjoys is only me. You know, but since I am its being, it can say, yeah, I'm a conscious being, because that's exactly what it is. But it doesn't go in the other way around. Conscious being won't say, yes, and I'm you, I'm the body. Won't say that because the body has no independent existence at all. And you can prove that logically. And that's why we have to do all of these, kind of a logical analysis of this world that seems so real. But when you analyze it, you can't find anything here of any kind of substance. Because everything comes into being and goes out of being, having non-being on either side of it. So how can it have being? Being doesn't come from non-being. Non-being doesn't exist. So here this is, it comes into being and goes out of being. It can't be, you know, it can't have non-existence as its foundation. But it's bordered by that. And so then if you start analyzing it to find out what the foundation is, you go smaller and smaller, names and forms, names and forms, names and forms, into an infinite regress. But all the way through that infinite regress, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, that never varies at all. So in the end, you have to imagine what would happen if I took out that final name and form, what would the substance be? And it's not going to be a name and form. What would it be? Not something you can see. something which you are, but not something you can see. You can't see existence. You can't see being. You can't see consciousness. But that, in the end, is what the substance is. Just think about it. You take off the form, and you're left with the substance. You don't feel the substance. You don't go to the forms within the forms within the forms. Just imagine taking off the form, and then what's that going to be? Not something that you can know or something that you can see, but it has to be the essence of what that form actually is, what that substance actually is. It truly can only be being itself, which it enjoys all the way down and all the way up. We just never think of it as a noun. We think of it as a meaningless, like a nomenclature. We say, this is. Why do we say that it is? Because here it is. It's not any statement at all about existence as a noun or existence even as an adjective. It only means it's a placeholder. This is. Why is it? Well, it's because it's here. So the word existence has basically no meaning other than just being a placeholder for all of these objects. You know, if they're here, they exist. Because why do they exist? Because they're here. You don't know about existence just in its own right. So, anyway.
It's interesting when you're talking like that, and then it's like we dismiss this whole thing. But it's like all that's here is Brahman. Even all the names and forms, we can't dismiss it. So then it's fine. Otherwise, it feels like almost a freak out. Like, what do you mean? This doesn't exist? Or there's nothing here, really? Is that this forms and stuff are also... it's hard to say.
No, I mean, the thing is... contradicting. We don't say it doesn't exist, right? That would be tucham. If you say something doesn't exist, it's not here to be experienced. The difference between mithya and tucham, in tucham, it's absolute non-existence, so it's none of us are ever going to experience it. It simply doesn't exist. Mithya, we're not saying that it doesn't exist. We say that its existence is dependent. It has a dependent existence. And why don't we just call it tucham, since it doesn't have its own existence? Why don't you say, well, it doesn't really exist at all? It does, though, in this sense. We experience it. I experience you. We experience science. We experience this infinite order. We experience this manifestation of infinite knowledge. And so it certainly has some sort of existence, you know. But when you analyze it, you find that the existence, and you, that's another interesting thing, you can analyze it and analyze it and analyze it. So here, this is as mithya as the thing we're analyzing. So the body is mithya, the sense organs are mithya, the brain is mithya, the whole creation is mithya. That means as you analyze it, you realize it has no being of its own. You just get into this infinite regress of names within names within names. But all the while, each one of those exists. As you do the infinite regress, you never get beyond existence. You never get outside of existence. And so you have to look at the whole creation as Brahman with Maya. Brahman is yourself. Okay? And Brahman is what actually is. And Brahman, from beginningless time, from the standpoint of the Maya, it has Maya as an attribute. It's called an incidental attribute because it doesn't bring about any change whatsoever to the self. But this incidental attribute, which is there from beginningless time, and really you can only place it in Brahman because Brahman is non-dual, Brahman, which is me, projects beginninglessly this creation. And whatever it projects will only take place in me because I'm the only thing that is here. There's nothing else but conscious being, which is infinite. Infinite in the sense of non-dual, not spatially infinite. And so whatever projects from this enjoys me completely for its being. But if I try to find the being and the reality within the names and forms, within the time and space, I can't find it. So to find the reality of all of this, I have to go to what its actual substance is. And its actual substance is one non-dual Brahman, which is myself. And so it's not as though we're exploding this creation. This creation is here and we experience it. But whose creation is it? Where does it come from? You know, what's its adhishtana? Who is the creator? How does this all happen? You know, and we experience it is. It absolutely exists. But then when we analyze the names and forms, we find that it doesn't exist. Right? Because they're just names and endless names, forms. We can never get to the substance because our sense organs won't allow us to see that. Our sense organs are only good for different types of names and forms, whether it be sounds or colors or taste. That's what our sense organs can give us. We can only perceive within this Maya, actually. The perceivers are the ones who are within the Maya, and they themselves are Maya. You know? But they themselves also are. They also exist. Because the Adhishtana is that existence. So, you have to say, here we are, and with science, and with the math and science and with all of the infinite order of this universe, you can't just dismiss it as nothing. I mean, it's something incredible. But when we look at what is actually here, everything is known. What is here is just an infinite expression of consciousness. And so now if we say it's an infinite expression of consciousness, then is this infinite expression, is it of the same order of reality as consciousness? Or is it a different order of reality? It's a different order of reality. It depends on consciousness for its being. It's not the same order of reality. You know, it has no being of its own, but it's not away from being at all. What Swamiji will say, instead of, you just have to say, okay, this is person consciousness. This is, you know, this is floor consciousness. This is lamp consciousness. This is clothes consciousness. Everything is really has for its adhishtana just one consciousness, one conscious being. And so that's how to understand this. And to understand it as Ishvara, like an infinite expression of knowledge. And we're part of that infinite expression. And within that infinite expression, there are infinite laws which contain all of us. It's kind of like a cell in the body. There are so many laws that are holding this body together and the functions of the body together. And every part of us, every cell is part of that order, exists within that order. So this is an infinite order that we find ourselves in. But then when we look at what is the absolute reality of it, is one non-dual consciousness. Does that help?
It's lovely to hear that answer.
Yeah. I understand. I think one thing that's very helpful when we get into these kind of discussions is to realize, well, you know, we're here. Here we are. We're just looking at what the absolute reality of the whole thing is so that I can understand who I am. But knowing who I am, here we are. Mm-hmm. You know? Having a nice time.
In Buddhism, it's kind of like the mithya is the not existent, right? That's how they base it. It is all really an illusion.
Kind of like how language that Nagarjuna, the Shunyata, one of the major commentator on Shunyata, that's his philosophy, Buddhist philosophy. He will say that all nama rupa is free of essence. It's shunyata. It's empty of essence. Empty of being. Empty. Whereas the paramarthika shunyata is empty of nama rupa. And name and form. And so he doesn't bring these two together. So he's in the language. I'd have to study much further to see if there's some way that he brings them together like satya mitya. But in the language and what I know so far, is that this would be mithya if he had an adhishtana. But here it is, And he said, this is shunyata, it's empty of any essence. So what if you said, it's empty of satchit? And then the absolute reality, paramartika shunyata, absolute emptiness, is free of nama-rupa. And so what we say in Vedanta is, it's just a little bit different. We could say conscious being is free of nama-rupa. It's free of name and form. We agree with that. It's Brahman is free of name and form. From the standpoint of Brahman, there's no name and form. And we can say that mithya has no essence, no conscious being in its own right, but it totally depends on consciousness, conscious being, for it has a dependent reality. It itself, if you were to take away the conscious being, it wouldn't be there to be experienced. So in the language, there's that little difference there. Sort of similar and different. Because the Buddha will have the shunyata, this free of essence out floating around, you know, on its own, you know, as the language stands. And then you have to realize by shutting all of this down in a way that absolute, non-dual shunyata. Non-dual, I say, because no nama-rupa. So it's got to be non-dual, and that has to be recognized. And so they say you take a statement like that and you have to teach that statement, you know. And so you can teach it in a way that would make sense also. Like here in this world, you can't find any type of essence because all your sense organs can do is perceive nama-rupa, you know. And nama-rupa goes into an infinite regress. They use the term infinite regress also. Mm. And so the more you... It's like peeling an onion that never gets peeled. You're peeling an infinite peeling of an onion, only to never find any core. And the fact is that if you're peeling the onion, means I'm analyzing out here, I'll never get to the end of it. It is like an infinite peeling of an onion. You never get to the bottom of it because your sense organs can't get you there. Your sense organs can only, you know, give you knowledge of name and form, which always, upon analysis, goes into an infinite regress, and you can't go past that. And so in that way, if you teach it that way, that's why the Buddha would say, or Nagarjuna would say, you know, this world of name and form has no essence. You can never get to the bottom of it. You can never find anything there. But you just have to keep going infinitely. So... On the other hand, that which is absolutely real has no name and form, which that immediately negates your ability to see it. You can only be it. He can't say that you are that because he has no words for it, because the Atma itself is mithya. What you call the Atma is anatma. And so you have no words. Because all vachart is the immediate meaning of the words, that's what we really have, unless there's a teaching methodology to use those words differently to point to yourself. But for the Buddha, if you say that shunyata, free of nama and rupa, is yourself, now you're misusing the language, because the self means this, and this is a conglomerate. And so we can't use that word, self, because that word is used in the world. And so what word do you use? We don't use a word. You have to recognize it. Yeah. Mm. You can use a word that is like nirvana or something. But those are also misleading. So you have to really use the Eightfold Path, you know, to come to that. Put yourself in a position where you can come to that realization. Makes sense.
Mm. Mm. Is it okay?
Sure.
Then, if we go back to your talk on the having that blueprint of the God image,
yeah,
it doesn't seem like that's there in Buddhism either. I mean, the God, in the, they make Buddha into a God. So then that would be quite lacking. It seems very unsettling, actually.
They use why can I think of the word for the the figures that live forever in the Mahayana.
Bodhisattvas? Or
the Bodhisattvas who... And so they actually become like devatas, even though technically they're not devatas. But it's that's part of the blueprint, because you have to have something to worship. So they don't believe in a god. But so then they make gods out of the bodhisattvas. They pray to them. They invoke their grace. All of that. And so they create a god. They create their own devata, like that. Which we all do. Everybody does that. And if you're really hostile to the word God or the word devata or something like that, then you'll create some sort of a god out of what Swamiji will, or and not Swamiji, but Jung will call the isms, like communism or capitalism or, you know, pluralism and all these various isms. That becomes the god, what contains you. Or money. Money also. Becomes power, becomes the god, the most important thing. Everything is for power, everything is for money. More and more and more. That's your devotion, that's your ultimate concern. It's replacing, that is where that archetype lands, on your highest value. It's interesting. It's called the secularization of the god image. But so you have to say, it's not that that God image isn't there. It is there even for atheists and for the Buddha or for any of the ones that don't have a God in the, you know, in a spiritual sense. But there's that archetype has to land somewhere. So it does. It lands in the world. Does that make sense? Yeah. I can differentiate my being from my emotions and thoughts, but I can't see how my being is the same being, the same consciousness of every other being. And I can't see its immortality. Can you unfold, please? Okay, there's a couple of things here. First of all, you're not ever going to see your being. You're only going to be your being. Self-evident. So it's your own self-experience, but it's not a subject-object experience for you to see your being or to see anybody else's being. So I can't look for somebody, let me see your being and let me see your being, and how is it that our beings are the same? I don't see how that's possible. You can't. So it's not going to be a recognition through your sensory perception. That's not going to happen. But when you do these different vivekas where I'm discriminating myself, right, the conscious being, from anything and everything that can be objectified, whether anything that I can have a subject-object relationship, there's two things are going to happen. I recognize something, and so I can differentiate myself from the thing that I recognize, subject-object. Then also, interestingly, is that if I'm objectifying something, I can recognize it moving and changing, and sometimes being present to me and sometimes not. Well, I'm constant. And so this is discrimination. I actually experience and recognize that fact. Okay? And so it's easy for us to recognize that subject-object in reference to the world, because we do that all the time. And I see that, well, I'm the subject and you're the object from my perspective, and I can see you move and change while I remain stationary. So the subject-object differentiation in reference to my body versus the world is something we are very well attuned to and don't even think twice about it, actually. But when we move in a step, then I have to realize that, well, the same sense organs that see the world outside of my body are the same sense organs that see this body. So this body actually is as objectified as the rest of the world is, by my five sense organs. That's how I know this body. And so now I recognize the subject-object differentiation, and I'm trying to stick with the subject, not with the things that are the anatma, the not me, because subject-object. So then I realize, okay, well, my sense organs themselves, they are also known by the mind and used by the mind. And so they also are objectified. And then I have to kind of make sure, are they really objectified? You know, and then I can give you some logics. Well, you know what? If your mind is daydreaming, when I'm teaching, this is Swamiji, just pretend like I'm Swamiji. When my mind is daydreaming, while your mind is daydreaming, well, I'm teaching a class, you know. he'll go like this. You'll be sitting there like this. Well, your sense organs are there. They're there, but they're not functioning at all because your mind's not using them. They're just there waiting for the mind to come back. But what you're experiencing is whatever your mind is doing, wherever your daydream is, right? And so the sense organs are organs. They're organs of sense for your perception of the world. But it is your mind that's aware of them, your mind that uses them, your mind that is innermost. And you know if your sense organs are working or not, if they're dimming out, if one isn't good. You know that. Who knows it? The mind. So the mind is innermost. Now the subject-object relationship, you have to let these things go. And you move inward, until you can say the mind. Now the mind is the subject, but no, the mind's not the subject, because I'm aware of the mind. There's a subject-object relationship. That's just a fact. I'm aware of my emotions, subject-object relationship. They come and go and change. I remain the same. Then you start, well, space itself I'm aware of. I'm aware of my knowledge. I'm aware of my ignorance. All subject-object relationship. And so now I have to just focus on the subject. After I've, even the ahankara is known to me. My relationships are known to me. The elements are known to me. Space is known to me. All of the things that exist in the world, internally in terms of the mind and thoughts in the mind, and externally in terms of my sense organs, they're all objectified. What is inner and what is outer is objectified. And then now the thing is, so you can see this, we take this step by step, and your mind goes, I recognize that. Now you're left in the end just with you, with nothing left to objectify, you know. And so now, say we're doing a teaching methodology and all of us are in the room going through the same thing. Now what happens is each one of us is left in this position of just being me, conscious being, different from the body, the mind, the sense organs, time, space. All of these are objectifiable. Each one of us is there now. Now the question is, okay, here's 15, 20 of us, just pure conscious being. Everything, even the knower known, has all been objectified. So now there's 20 of us. What is going to divide me from you to make 20 of us? 20 conscious beings. What's in between us to make the 20? Space? No. Nope. Because space is objectified, right? I'm aware of space. So space isn't going to be it. The ahankara. We each have our own ahankara. No. Ahankara is a thought. It's objectified. Our minds. Each one of our minds is different. Yeah, but the mind is not me. It's objectified. Well, our bodies at least. No, the body's objectified, for heaven's sake. Yeah. Right? So what makes me different from you when we get to this place of just me? Differentiated from all of the things that can be objectified, what would now make us two? There is nothing. There's nothing to come in between, because the whole universe, beginning with time and space, that whole manifestation, right, has for its adhishtana, me, conscious being. Where are there two me's? Because you need to have space. You need to have time and space to be able to differentiate one thing from another. There's no time and space, there's not two. So that's what we say. I am a different order of reality than the dual experience that includes space, air, fire, water, earth, and everything in it, all of the elementals, all of the people, all of the jivas, all of the minds, all of the sense organs. Those all belong to Maya. So now, how can I say that this me, that is aparoksha, self-evident, swatta siddha, self-evident, you know, swaprakasha, self-shining as consciousness. What is my rationale for saying that there's two of me? How? You have to figure out a way for there to be two. And anything you say will already be within Maya, will be within time and space. So it's not possible for there to be two unless there's two non-dual consciousness existing in time and space. But how can that be possible? Non-dual consciousness is not an object to be objectified. Yourself is not objectifiable to be anything other than what it is, actually. So there's no room for two. So this isn't about experiencing that there's not two. You're not going to have an experience that there's not two. You're going to recognize that there's only one because there can't be two. There can't be two me's. There can be two me's in terms of two bodies or two minds or two sense organs, two sets of sense organs or two ahankaras. But there can't be, that can only be within ignorance where I'm identifying with an upadhi that is actually objectifiable. But when I'm just down to myself, then what, even for the Atma, if you say, well, what color am I? What color am I? You can say what color your skin is. You can say what color your clothes are. You can say what color anything your eyes are. Anything that has the anupadi within time and space, it has all of these, what we call gunas, qualities, and kriyas, ways of action, and sambandha, different types of relationships, and all of that. That all exists within time and space. But for me, like, how much do I weigh? How big am I? Anything like that just falls right off because it's totally inapplicable. You have to be an object within time and space to be able to hang these things on it, these kind of attributes and qualities. Yourself is just me. Me without all of these dresses. If you take all the things off of me that have been superimposed, what is left? Just simply me. Not big, not small. Not a color, not a size, not a weight, just conscious being. That's all. Which is the best word for conscious being is me. That's all. When I think of me, that's what we mean by conscious being. And it can't be two. To be two, I could look at it because it would be an object in the creation. It could be objectified. I could have a subject-object relationship with it. I don't have a subject-object relationship with me. The only reason I am known is because I'm consciousness and I'm self-evident. So I don't need to have a subject-object relationship because I'm the very one that illumines everything. I'm the luminary. You know? But there's just not possible for there to be two of us. Which is so good because I know exactly who you are. You know, I know exactly who you are. And that's very comforting. You know. I know your body and you have a different body and you have a different mind and you have different sense organs, but who you are is me. Or two me's. And so it's the logic that helps you to recognize the fact of that. The experience is self-evident, but that there's not two me's, you have to understand through analysis that there can't be two me's. Does that make sense? Because we want to kind of know that in the way that we're used to knowing things subject-object, but that self can't become an object to know it in that way. You can only be it and then remove from it all of the ajnana that has caused these misidentifications. Is that good enough? But I can't see how my being is the same being, the same consciousness of every other being. Because you say I can't see how. you can't see that. You can't see it. You can only be that and recognize it's not possible for it to be any other way. Yeah. In meditation, I imagined myself being Ishwara without any jiva upadhi. That made my mind wonder if there is any experience at all for a jnani after the body dies. If the body and sukshma sharira goes back to the five elements and the jnani becomes Ishwara, is there any experience of being Ishwara? It would be, first of all, when for the jnani, there is no reason now for any of these body, mind, sense organs to go on looking for ananda. That search for ananda is kind of the gasoline that keeps the jiva together, but when your mind is already resolved in jivan mukta, while living itself, the mind is not reveling here, it's reveling around the self in Ishwara. It's not reveling, looking for another object that it needs to have to be happy. That quest resolves itself. Then the things that I pursue are just mithya. It's my prarabdha karma. You know, this is why I'm here, for to have these experiences, and that will go. Those experiences will go on unfolding until they're done. So the prarabdha karma ends when it ends. And that means that you'll be engaged in this life in whatever way is real for you, is your prarabdha karma. That will just go on unfolding, and you'll have mithya desires that will rise up in order to impel you towards something else. I say mithya, non-binding desires, because you're already full and complete. You're not looking for the universe to make you happy. It's more of a wonder and joy of how what Ishwara is doing, you know. Because you already have the ananda, the wholeness of yourself, so you don't need the world to come and try to make you happy, which never works. That's why you became a mumukshu, you know, because you figured that out. and so you have an interest in Vedanta. If you hadn't figured that out to some extent, then Vedanta wouldn't be meaningful. But because you've figured out that all of the sukha that you get is very transitory, you know, and so, what am I doing here? What's this all about? And this isn't there. Who am I? I remember when I was little praying to Bhagavan to come and see me and tell me what's going on. I used to look at the walls and kind of, this, I was young, so squint and see if I, by squinting, maybe I could see in there, squint. We need to know who we are. Lost that question. What was it? So the experience of the jnani when the body dies is just the self experience that is always there, not somebody new, just yourself without any of the limiting adjuncts. Or limiting complexes, all of that, those aren't there. So you just are Brahman with Maya. So you are Ishwara. So whatever Ishwara's experience is your experience. So you say, well, would I experience the creation? If the creation is up, you'll experience the creation. If the creation is resolved, you'll just be with yourself in Nirvikalpa Samadhi. Because the Maya will go into its unmanifest condition with no jnanam. And so you just be like breathing, which is what they say in the Vedas. It's like the creation is like breath, breathing in and out. It's creation. In, out. So it's the breathing of the creation in a way. It's kind of a nice image. So whatever your form is as Ishwara will be there. Whenever the Ishwara is there, because from the standpoint of the Atma, from the standpoint of yourself, there's just nothing else but you, the Satchitatma. But the creation is experienced when it's there. You know, just like your dream is experienced when it's there, not when it's not there. Or your imagination is experienced when it's there, not when it's not there. But when it's there, then that experience with all of its infinite, the infinite knowledge, the infinite expression of it, that is experienced. It's hard for us as jivas to, impossible probably, I would say impossible, unless you get that, what Arjuna asked Krishna for, that divine chakshu, that divine eye. You know, he wanted Krishna to give him an experience of his Ishwara Upadhi. And for some reason, Krishna agreed to do it. Okay. He gave him that blessing to have that experience of the Ishwara Upadhi. He couldn't wait to get Krishna back. I want you back in your other form. I don't want to see this anymore. It's too much. It's too much for me. Because he still had that ahankara, you know. Is this jiva experiencing this infinite form? And if you read that, I think it's chapter 11 of the Gita. It's like this whole creation is continuing eating itself, folding in on itself, because there's just continual birth and death happening. And so he saw all of these, everybody that he knows, all of the people in the war, all of the people in his community, all just being chewed, coming in, taking birth, and being folding back in, folding back in, folding back in, everything. And it was frightening for him.
Yeah. But then it sounds like Ishvara has some kind of sense organs to experience.
No, it doesn't require sense organ, just
or
like...
Or maybe Brahman, or how...
No, the sense organ is not a sense organ. The best, I think, a good way to understand that is if you have an imagination, you are experiencing that. Your mind has an imagination. So the sattva runs through the whole mind, through the whole imagination. So the whole imagination is known. Whereas for a jiva, like, we get to be little Ishwaras in terms of our use of imagination. You know, even in dream. Because you can, the dream comes from you, is sustained by you, resolves into you. When the dream is up, it is known. It's not because you have a sense organ to experience it. From the standpoint of just the dream itself, then you can have characters within the dream that are experiencing the dream through their sense organs. Right? Those are the jivas in your dream. But you, as the Ishwara of the dream, the whole thing is known. Along with all the characters running through and having their experiences, the whole thing is known. And that's because the dream is a manifestation of the mind, which is sattva, predominantly sattva. And so the whole thing is known. So like that, the whole Ishwara, with the sattva, which is a manifestation of Maya in Brahman. Remember that Maya is sattva, rajas, and tamas, right? And so for the Ishwara Upadhi, the sattva, rajas, and tamas are pervasive. Just think, in the creation, there's no place that's free of rajas. Everything is in continual motion. Just go to the level of atoms. There's nothing that's not in motion. That's rajas. And the sattva is that which, as though, kind of reflects or manifests consciousness. That's also pervasive to the whole creation from a Vedic standpoint. And that being so, the entire infinite creation is known, not because there's a knower, but because it's sattva. Sattva runs through it. And then consciousness, which is the experience of known, it is known, it is known, it is known. The whole universe, the whole Maya Upadhi is known because of the sattva. And then the self of the whole thing is me, is conscious being, Brahman. But Brahman doesn't have a sense organ. The sense organs or the pervasion of sattva exists, you know, in Maya. Not in Brahman. From the standpoint of Brahman, it's just conscious being, which is Ananda, or which is the beloved. We call it that which is the most dear. And that which is the most dear is what is, what it actually is. Everything else is mithya. Maybe that's the best I can do right now. So yes, there's an experience of being Ishvara, either from the standpoint of the Savikalpa Samadhi, I mean the Nirvikalpa Samadhi, or the experience of the creation. But it's not the Atma that is experiencing that. It's the self, it's the Maya Upadhi that has the self as its conscious being. It's just like right now, here I am, and there's two things happening. I just simply am as I am. But then from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, I'm seeing, I'm talking, I'm walking, and all of these things. There's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Gita, seeing I don't see, walking I don't walk, blinking I don't blink, hearing I don't hear. It goes on and on for five or six different things because it's two standpoints. From the standpoint of me, I'm not doing anything or experiencing anything other than just conscious being, other than myself, the me. But from the standpoint of the Upadhi, which has me for its adhishtana, then I am walking and talking and thinking and all of these things, seeing, hearing, and, you know, doing all of these things. But that's from the standpoint of the Upadhi, not from the standpoint of the self. Sounds weird, but that's the truth of it, and that's your experience also. That's what you have to realize. This is actually your experience, and it's always been this way, so everything's fine. Mm-hmm. Nothing to fear. Can you please talk about the manas? What does it do? I see how it causes me pain. Does it have a positive aspect as well? I'm too tired. I'll do it tomorrow, though. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. Yeah. Sometimes it's like a switch turns off in my brain. And when that happens, I just give up because it's too hard to turn it back on. It's just so over for the night.
Swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishah ko brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukino bhavantu kale varshatu parjanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yamcho varahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarvesham swastir bhavatu Sarvesham shantir bhavatu Sarvesham purnam bhavatu Sarvesham mangalam bhavatu Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve patrani pasyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amritangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate Purnasya purnamadaya purnamevavashishyate Om shanti shanti shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi